Mackenzie.
And I'm Amy.
We're switching it up a little bit this week on Sheer Crime. Normally, we would take you step by step through the documentary we are covering in that episode, but today we are going to talk about a case that isn't really crimey, but still piques our curiosity due to its mysterious nature. I need to start off by apologizing because last week I had mentioned that this case was on Hulu, but it's actually on HBO Max. They must have switched it.
Yeah, I had to pay for it. I found it on Amazon Prime. It was only $3.99, but still.
Well, and I had seen this episode years ago.
Right.
And so it's been a while since I watched it, and it was on Hulu the last time I watched it. So yeah. a little bit different.
They need to stop switching things.
Sorry, guys. We are covering the documentary called There's Something Wrong with Aunt Diane. It is truly bizarre, puzzling, literally leaves you questioning everything because it seems like it would be so clear cut and it really is not.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of feelings that come into this one.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So with all of the feelings, what are we dulling them with this week? What are we drinking?
Well, this week we are really switching it up.
Yeah.
This is something I have never even heard of before. It's called High Noon Sun Sips.
I like it.
And it is a vodka soda.
Ooh.
Essentially. And it is a pineapple flavor.
Love me some pineapple.
So I'm hoping that it's good. I've never even heard of it before, but
hey,
let's try it out, right?
I'm game.
Hmm.
Not bad.
That's interesting.
It's a bit more seltzery than our Crooked Marker.
Yes.
But it's not as seltzery as like a White Claw.
Right.
In my opinion.
It's kind of a little bit in between.
Yeah.
I was hoping for maybe a little bit more pineapple flavor.
Yeah.
But it's not bad.
It's not bad.
It's good.
Yeah.
I would drink it again.
I'm glad it's not super vodka-y.
I know. I was a little nervous and I was like, ooh, are we really going above and beyond today by getting a vodka and soda?
Well, I mean, judging by the case that we're covering today, I think vodka was a very good choice.
And I literally did not even put two and two together. Guys, I promise.
This was not a pun. This was an accident.
No, this was literally by chance.
Now, the documentary starts out with a 911 call coming into State Police Sergeant Temple. The caller is Brad Katniss, and I'm going to quote what he said. So he says, "My name is Brad Katniss. I'm actually trying to help a friend right now, and I need some information. Their children are on their way home from a camping trip with their aunt. They just called my friend's house in distress, saying that the aunt is driving erratically, and the aunt isn't picking up the phone right now." There's then another call that comes in, and the woman says that there is a woman driving the car. They think that she's having a medical emergency because she called and she couldn't talk anymore, and she's got 5 kids in the car.
Horrifying. So,
yes. And then it goes on to say, the father and the husband are here, or the father and brother are here at the station. So there's a lot of calls that are just kind of coming in. They're not real clear as far as who they are, what's going on, other than the fact that we know something is not right.
There's a sense of panic, a lot of panic in the air.
Yes. Another call comes in. Now, this one is from a frantic caller, and she's trying to figure out which road she's on, trying to tell the police where they are so that they can get there as soon as possible. And she says something to the effect of, there's little kids. There's kids not moving. Yeah, there's a whole bunch of kids. Honestly, the car is smashed.
Oh, my gosh.
Right?
It literally gave me goosebumps because it's the real call.
Yes.
This is obviously the actual phone call from that day. And this woman is panicked.
Oh, she's just an eyewitness. She has no idea what she just came upon, but she knows it's bad.
I don't know what I would do in that scenario seeing that.
I don't either.
Seeing that happen in real time and in real life, it is tragic. And obviously, they show us pictures of what it looked like. And this car is burnt to a crisp. I've never seen anything like it.
No. Do you know what it reminded me of? And I actually wrote it down. It looked like a pop can that's been sitting in a bonfire.
Oh, my gosh. Yes.
Right? You know how they at first kind of just start to like crumple in on themselves? That's what this looked like.
Absolutely.
And I was like, ew, that's so creepy.
Oh,
it
was creepy.
Now, all of these 911 calls are coming in before even the opening credits.
Yes.
So it's a jump right in head first.
It is intense from moment one.
Yes. Yes. We then see on screen text and it says, on Sunday, July 26th, 2009, Diane Schuler drove the wrong way on the Taconic Highway for almost 2 miles, crashing and killing 8 people. Herself, her daughter, 3 nieces, and all 3 people in the oncoming vehicle.
So tragic.
For real.
Oh.
It then cuts to her husband in front of some TV reporters, right?
It looks like a press conference.
Yeah.
Yep.
And he says, and I quote, "She was a perfect wife, an outstanding mother, a hard worker, a reliable person, trustworthy. I would marry her again tomorrow if I could. She's awesome. She's the best," end quote. So he had a lot of, you know, good things to say about her.
A lot of admiration for his wife. He truly loved her. And you could tell that he was sticking up for her in every sense of the word. He was really trying to make sure that her name didn't get dragged through the mud.
Yeah. Yeah. And that stays consistent through the entire documentary.
Yes, it does.
He's very much pro Diane.
Absolutely.
Through this whole thing. The next thing that they show on the documentary is some gas station footage, literally like from the building of the gas station, looking out onto the pumps.
Mm-hmm.
And you see her van pulling up to a pump. She gets out and walks into the convenience store, kind of walks back to an aisle, but then almost immediately comes right back towards the door, stops and asks the clerk something at the front.
Very quickly.
Very quickly. I mean, she hardly stopped. She just kind of was like walking and talking.
And of course, they don't have audio, so we don't get to hear anything. It's just a visual. But I mean, this conversation, whatever was said, was very, very quick. And she was out the door.
Yeah. She doesn't buy anything. She just walks out, drives away. Now, Jay Schuler, she's the other main person in this documentary. It's the husband, Daniel Schuler, and then Jay Schuler. Now, Jay is Diane's sister-in-law. So she's married to Daniel's brother, Jimmy.
Correct. Yep.
And Jay is looking at this footage, this gas station footage, and she says, and then she just drives away. "I've watched this like numerous times over and over again, and she was fine. And that's what's so frustrating."
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't look impaired in any way, shape, or form. She just looks like a woman on a mission, in my opinion.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure I've done that before. I've stopped somewhere that didn't have something I wanted, and I'm in and out, lickety split, right?
Yep.
Next up on the screen is some news coverage. Now, it kind of jumps back and forth throughout this entire documentary. So I apologize up front if it's hard to follow, but we're going to try our best to keep you on track.
Yes. Yep. They're really going all over the place. But
yeah,
it does make sense when you're watching it and the context of it. You need to have a little bit of that back and forth, but it can be a little challenging over a podcast. So
right.
Apologies.
So we will, you know, sip. We need a drink.
Yes, we do.
Next on the screen is news coverage. And they're talking about how they had found a burned shell of a minivan. It had been traveling the wrong way down the parkway, had collided head on with another vehicle, and that the children were all ejected from the vehicle.
Oh.
They say that there was one lone survivor in this crash. There were 9 people involved in the crash total. One survived, and it was her 5-year-old son, Brian.
It's a miracle, really.
Oh, seriously.
I mean, how does anyone survive that if she's going that fast
and head on
down the highway? Oh my gosh.
I know. It terrifies me. Literally my nightmare.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Now, Daniel, Diane's husband, and forgive me, but I'm going to start calling him Danny because that's what they call him throughout the documentary. And it just seems easier to me.
It's easier. I was doing the same thing. I started calling him Daniel like halfway through and then Danny.
Yeah. So, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So we're just going to flip him right to Danny.
Yep. He's Danny.
Yep. So Danny says that when he first got the phone call, he didn't know what had actually happened. He just went upstate to the hospital and found out there. So he knew that there was an accident, but he didn't have any details. So he just drove right up to the hospital and found out everything while he was there.
Can you imagine?
No.
Going through that and not knowing what's happening?
Right.
A car accident's never really good, ever.
Right.
I mean, the chances of dying in a car accident is high. Because of the rate of speed that you're going and depending on what you hit and how you hit and all that kind of stuff. And when he knew that there was children in the car, that sinking feeling I'm sure he felt in his gut, I cannot even imagine that. I mean, you instantly probably have so much fear and dread. It's unbelievable. I can't imagine it.
No. Now, Jimmy, Danny's brother, says that the original phone call that they got left Daniel thinking that Brian, his son, had died and that everybody else was okay. So That's how, you know, flip-flopping this whole thing is. And to be honest, I think a big part of it is the fact that because it was such a horrific accident and because there were so many children, they don't really know who those kids are. So yeah. Like they can see the registration on the vehicle as being, you know, so-and-so. They can see a driver's license, but children don't have identification.
Well, right.
So they don't really know who they are.
When we found out that the vehicle was actually registered to Jackie Hance,
right.
Who is Diane's sister-in-law.
Yeah, married to Diane's
brother. Yeah.
Now, Jay, Jimmy's wife, had actually gone over to family and had told them that Brian had passed away, but then almost immediately afterwards got a phone call from her husband saying, "It's really bad, Jay. Everyone's gone."
I'm getting goosebumps thinking about it again. I mean, imagining that type of conversation and the feelings associated with it. I think your body would go into some sort of a shock.
It does.
Or disbelief.
Yeah,
that you can't believe that something like that would happen when so many tragic losses happen at one time.
Oh.
It has to happen like that, right?
Oh, yeah. Because it seems so unnatural, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So like hearing, you know, if somebody gets sick and they pass away, I mean, you're kind of, I hate to say kind of used to the idea, or at least you have kind of come to terms with the idea that that's maybe where it's heading.
Yeah.
Of course, we all hope for cures, but, you know, in certain cases, we just know that's not how it's going to happen.
And you're expecting it a little bit.
Right. That's maybe the word. Yeah.
You know that it's going to happen at some point. You kind of make peace with it. You say your goodbyes, your I love yous, you do all that kind of stuff. But in a scenario like this,
nobody had an idea this was happening.
Nobody knew this something like this would ever happen. And how tragic. How tragic.
Yeah. They then cut to some funeral footage. I wrote down so many coffin carrying hearses in the parking lot. I was just like, holy shit. Lots of spectators and press around, which I'm not surprised.
Especially with this amount of children.
And that's what I think it was.
Yes.
I think it was a lot of outpouring from the community.
Yeah.
Throughout the funeral footage, we then have the voice of Warren Hance. Now, Warren was Diane's brother.
Yes.
Now, Warren was also married to Jackie Hance. They are the parents of three girls that were in this crash with Diane. So Diane had in the car with her son, Brian, her daughter, Erin, and then three of her nieces who were all siblings and belonged to Warren and Jackie. Now, at the funeral, Warren is saying, and I quote, "My sister was a phenomenal mother, aunt, and friend, and all of us are grateful for the love and care that she showered upon our entire family, especially all of our children. What we ask all of you going forward is that you keep my girls, my sister, and my niece, and all of us in your daily prayers. There is a miracle child in all of this, our dear nephew Brian, who's getting better and stronger by the day, and who will be loved by more people than he will ever understand. Love your children, cherish your children, kiss your children, and don't ever forget." And there's just sobbing.
You can hear sobs in the background.
He's choked up. I mean, how can you not be?
Well, right. And I think he is just such a good person.
Yeah.
If that were me in my shoes, I think I would harbor a lot of hate, even though it's my sister or my brother or whomever that was driving. All of my kids are gone.
Yeah.
All of my children are gone and I'll never see them again. And that would be hard.
Yeah.
I'm hoping and praying I never have to live through something like that. But just thinking about it, that's how I would feel. And he doesn't seem to harbor any hate for her at all.
No. Well, and at this time, they're all victims. So he's, you know, not only is he at this moment burying his three children, he's also burying his sister, who we later find out was a big role in his life and the life of his family.
Mm-hmm.
And they're burying their niece. So it's like, it's got to be just kind of almost too much.
Yeah.
And I totally get that.
Absolutely. We're now 5 days later, and this is after the funeral. We see the New York State Police having a press conference on August 4th of 2009. The autopsy had been done on Diane Schuler at the Westchester County Medical Center, and the toxicology report states that her blood alcohol content was 0.19%, which we find out is approximately 10 drinks. Now, this basis is off of her weight.
Her body weight.
Her body weight. And we both kind of talked about it, and we want to say that she probably weighs around 220, 240-ish, maybe. So that's 0.19 of her body weight and 10 drinks for her body weight. So it's not always consistent per person, but that's the information that we get.
Yeah. So that's why they can say that somebody who is, you know, small and petite can get to that 0.08, which is that legal driving limit or legal limit, faster than somebody who is, you know, a bigger, stronger, more muscular person or whatever. So yeah, it's very much dependent on the person.
Yes.
Now, I did a little bit of a Google dive because I was curious. So when they talk about being at 0.19% blood alcohol content, they're looking at, you know, different effects on the body. And generally, they said that, you know, this could be like nausea, higher anxiety levels, kind of that quote unquote, like sloppy drunk kind of look, and could easily pass out at any point. So we've all been there.
Yeah.
We've certainly seen people in this state before.
Yes.
This is definitely not, you know, you're not functional as much.
Well, yeah. And this is over twice the legal limit. So the legal limit to drive in New York State is 0.08 or below.
Right.
So she was over double the legal limit, almost 2.5 times over the legal limit.
I would say that's a lot. Yeah,
it's a lot.
10 drinks for somebody. And it also said, it was on health.com. They were saying that your body can get rid of one drink per hour. Now, one drink equals 1.5 ounces of 80 proof liquor, like a vodka or whiskey or something like that. It could also be equivalent to 12 ounces of beer or a 5 ounce glass of table wine. So just to give you a little context, 10 drinks, you know, would be like 10 shots.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, her toxicology report also showed high levels of THC, which is the active ingredient in marijuana, which we probably already knew. But
sure did.
So we get to meet the Shuler family attorney. His name is Dominic Barbara. We meet him at the press conference that's held after they find out the autopsy findings. So Dominic basically states that Diane was not an alcoholic. She rarely drank.
Yeah.
And Danny, of course, needs to chime in and say something too about his wife. And he states that she did not drink. Something medically had to have happened to her. The trip that should have only taken about 30 minutes drive time for her took 4 hours.
Yeah. That was so weird.
Yes. Yeah, he is adamant that something medically happened to her. Now, we do find out later they did do things. So they went to the gas station, they went to get food. They did do things, but then all the weird stuff started to happen after that.
And there was so much time.
Yeah, it was
too much time.
Really strange. And that's when her behavior started to act weird. She wasn't answering her cell phone. There was a lot of things that kind of come into play later on where you're like, what in the hell could have happened?
Yeah.
Now, Jay Shuler speaks again. She's the sister-in-law to Diane, and she states that family was the most important thing to Diane. There's no way she would ever jeopardize the children. And we hear this again and again and
Broken record throughout this whole documentary. Yeah.
Every single person in her life tells you how much she loved her kids and how she would never, ever put anything in their way to jeopardize her life.
Yeah.
Ever.
Family was everything to her.
Family was first.
Yep.
Now, once the autopsy reports were made public, you see a lot of stuff coming out on the internet.
Yeah.
So lots of trolls, lots of comments, lots of opinions. And we see Jay and her son, Evan, are actually online.
Ugh.
Looks like MySpace or Facebook or something.
Yeah.
Must have been Facebook. But they're looking at comments on the internet and they just are in disbelief by all these terrible things that people are saying about Diane. And all I had down was that is never a good idea.
No.
Don't do it.
Stay off the internet.
It's not a good thing. Everyone's going to have their own opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these people have no idea what your guys' story is. They don't know your family. They don't know who you are, but they like to put their two cents in. That's what social media is about. So I found that really interesting because it looked like they'd been sitting there for a long time.
Oh, yeah.
Looking and scrolling through these different pages and comment threads and all this stuff on social media, and just don't. Not a good idea.
No, definitely not.
We see on-screen text And it states that 6 months after the accident, the filmmakers approached the Shulers about making an investigative documentary on the Taconic tragedy.
Yeah, and that might be kind of their slang term to this case out in that area, the Taconic tragedy.
Right. So the film crew is behind the camera. You hear them talking. They're speaking to the family. And they say, we will do every test recommended. We will go down all the avenues. What if it doesn't come up with any new evidence?
Yeah.
And they say they don't want to go down that path. And we can tell they really, really don't want to think about the worst case scenario in this tragedy.
Yeah. And the worst case scenario at this point is just that the toxicology report was 100% true.
Correct. Now, Dominic Barber, their lawyer, is speaking on screen, and he's a cocky one, isn't he?
He's been there, done that. He's bought the t-shirt.
Yes, he likes to talk about himself.
Yep.
He basically states that they picked him because they wanted to go public with this. And he's catching a lot of grief with this case than the Mary Buttafuoco case and the Jessica Hahn case. He's friends with celebrities. You know, he's just name-dropping people left and right. I'm like, oh, typical lawyer. You know, that's
so New York.
It is. It's so New York. And so I just found that to be a little tidbit, a little funny. Daniel then comes back and tells us that he wants to know what happened to his wife. He wants the truth. He wants a correct autopsy done, and he wants to know if she had a stroke. So that was another thing that they thought about, was maybe she had a stroke during this whole ordeal.
Yeah.
And that is why her behavior was so different and erratic, and she didn't know where she was and what she was doing and all this kind of stuff, which I was like, hey, I never even thought of that. That could totally be something that happened.
Absolutely.
But again, we have to go down that whole rabbit hole and figure out if that could ever actually be true. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Because that would have been something that would have come up on the autopsy. But
yes,
the family believes that they tested her blood alcohol, found the marijuana in her system, and kind of stopped the autopsy at that point, being like, nope, drunk driving. That's it.
And I think they also were thinking that it wasn't hers.
Yeah.
Like the sample wasn't hers.
Yeah.
Which I kind of found a little strange, but you never know, I guess.
Yeah. You never know. We then see on screen text, 20 miles from the Shuler home is Floral Park, New York, where Diane grew up. She was born in 1973, the fourth child of Warren Hance Sr. and Eileen McCoe, and the only girl. When Diane was 9 years old, her mother left the family.
Oh. So rough at 9 years old.
Yeah. So they show some pictures and she is the only girl of four children. The other three are boys.
Yeah.
So she is now the little woman of the house, right?
Yeah. And that's a lot of responsibility.
Yeah. And it sounds like she kind of took that role. Mm-hmm. She became the housekeeper. She became the, you know, the keeper of all the boys. And it sounds like she kind of thrived in that position. But I'm guessing a lot of it had to do with maybe her feeling like she had to.
I mean, absolutely.
Her dad was now a single parent to four kids. So, right. I mean, that's got to be a lot for him, too.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Now, Danny, her husband, says that she rarely ever spoke about her mother, says that, you know, she just left when she was young. Seemed like it bothered her, but she wouldn't talk about it.
Right.
So she wasn't. We get the impression from him, and also we get told later from her friends, she wasn't somebody who would walk around with a victim mentality. She wasn't going to make that her identity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is a good thing.
Yeah.
I think that's a good thing. Absolutely. But I think you also probably need to get
deal
some help at some point. Talk to someone about it. Because when you keep that kind of stuff hidden, it can really bottle up inside and be a lot more pain than you think it is.
Yeah. It can manifest in other ways, too.
Absolutely.
Jay Shuler then goes on to say that she actually had heard that Diane's mother had shown up to the funeral, but that she had never met her, never spoke to her. And nobody knows why she left her dad, according to the family. So again, Diane doesn't talk about it much.
We hear later on in the documentary that she apparently left with one of their friends who was also their neighbor. So it looks like she left him for another man.
Yeah.
Is what it seems like. But to leave your four children?
Yeah.
That seems like something mentally would be wrong there too to me, because that's not a normal motherly instinct type of thing. There's usually something underlying that's triggering you to not have that need to be with your children.
Yeah, that maternal connection.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you birthed these babies, you know, I mean, they were a part of you for 10 months, all four of them, you know, so that was a little weird to me.
Very weird. And Jay says that she thinks that this whole thing had a major impact on her, on Diane's parenting. She was super mom through and through. We then cut back to Danny, and he's talking to the reporters at the press conference, kind of taking everybody through that day, what happened.
Yeah.
So essentially, they had been camping for the weekend. And so Sunday morning was when all of this occurred.
Yeah.
He's talking about how he had woken up at about 6 a.m. He went down to the dock to clean out his boat and probably get that loaded up. He came back to the camper at about 7 a.m. and woke up Diane. She then started packing bags, cleaning up the camper, waking up the kids, you know, all of the things that you normally do when you're leaving a campsite.
Absolutely. We know a lot about that here in Minnesota. There's lots of cabins up north.
Lots and lots. And everybody leaves that so early on Sunday. Yes. I'm always like, why? So she gets all of the bags packed and she gets them out of the camper. And Danny's job is to then load those bags up into the car.
Mm-hmm.
So he starts loading everything up into the 2003 Ford minivan that they had borrowed from her brother and his wife.
Yeah. Yeah. To make sure they could haul all the kids.
Yeah. Because they didn't have, I mean, they only had two kids. So they wouldn't have any need to have, I mean, they could have a minivan, right? But they didn't have one.
Well, and they had a truck that would easily be able to fit their family of four.
Right.
But not three more nieces. Yeah. So,
and they had their dog with them. So Danny took the dog. And so he was driving the truck, had the dog, had the camper, probably the boat.
Mm-hmm.
And then she had the minivan with all the kids and all the bags, which I thought was weird. Why wouldn't you just keep the bags in the camper? But I digress.
Right.
They had been up at Hunter Lake Campground, and Danny had said that it was a great weekend. They were swimming, hiking, campfires, cooking marshmallows. There was a game room there that they had took the kids to. There was a playground. There's tons of pictures flashing on the screen during this time of, you know, Danny and Diane with the kids camping.
Yeah.
Them on the dock, the kids, you know, standing by a rock, like, obviously, your typical family vacation, right?
It's nice to have those photos, too, because this tragedy happened literally a day after or 2 days after these photos were taken.
Yeah.
Which can be a little haunting, but it's probably a nice thing to have, like, that last memory of these kids, you know?
Especially with them saying that it was such a great weekend.
Yeah.
So it was probably, like, a nice, like, memory.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Now, on Sunday, July 26, 2009... Again, Danny says that they got up, they had breakfast, they made coffee, cleaned out the camper, said goodbye to all the kids. She took the kids in her car, meaning the minivan, and he drove separately. Now at 9 a.m., Diane's brother, Warren Hance, receives a call. James Boyle of the New York State Police, he's an investigator, says that Emma Hance, Warren and Jackie's oldest daughter, calls her dad saying that everything was good, they had a great time, and they were happy to be coming home. So just giving them a heads up.
Yeah.
We had a good time. We're heading home. We'll see you soon.
Breaks my heart.
I know. Now, the campground owner, Ann Scott, kind of talks about how it's a popular place for people to get away from the city, you know, just get out into nature. It's very calming, relaxing. She says that that morning when they're leaving the campground, Danny was parked up front with his truck with the dog. And that Diane was right behind them in the minivan with all the kids. The kids were yelling back and forth, having a good time, yelling about wanting to come back again. She, meaning Anne, yells out to them, you know, tells them to have a safe trip home. And that was that. They pull out of the campground and take off.
Yeah.
And Anne says she certainly seemed completely sober to her at that time. Nothing triggered her to think anything otherwise.
And nothing seemed out of the ordinary.
No.
They're just leaving. Everything's packed up. Good to go. It's around 9:30 a.m.
Right.
I mean, I don't even think she would assume anyone would be drunk or, you know, out of sorts.
Right.
So it makes sense.
Yeah. So they're leaving the campground, like you said, about 9:30 in the morning. Diane did have to stop at the gas station. And then she had also told Danny that she was going to stop and get the kids breakfast at a McDonald's that was near the campground. Because, again, the campground was only about 30, 35 minutes from their home. So it wasn't like they were going far, but they were going to be stopping at a McDonald's quick for some breakfast before heading home.
Exactly. Yep.
My guess is the kids were probably still sleeping while, you know, Danny and Diane had their breakfast that morning.
Yes. And we hear actually from Joseph Becerra. He's that New York State police investigator. And he's kind of recreating the story of what happened after they left the campground.
Yes.
They give us a little bit more detail because there's timestamps. So like you had stated, they get to the McDonald's at around 9:56 a.m. They had actually obtained a video that had been timestamped. The cashier said that there was no alcohol smell. Nothing seemed out of the ordinary when they ordered the food. And then the kids ended up playing in the playground for a little bit.
Yeah.
We then see them at the Sunoco gas station. That's the gas station that we saw that video we first talked about.
Yes.
At the top of this episode.
Which has become like the infamous gas station footage.
And they show us, I think, like 3 or 4 times.
Oh, yeah.
This video over and over again. And it's haunting. It's really haunting because they're trying to figure out what went wrong. Because everything.
When did it go wrong?
Yes. Yeah. At what time and when did it change? Now, we're at the Sunoco gas station at 10:46 a.m. And we learned that she had went into the gas station asking for pain meds that they didn't have.
Yeah.
Which I thought was very interesting and telling. Could that be a sign of that medical issue they were talking about? So she was in some sort of pain at this point, we know, because you don't stop somewhere to get pain meds unless you're really in pain.
Sure.
You want to make it home.
Especially when you're only 30 minutes away.
Yes, yes. But she must have been in enough pain to say, hey, I need to stop and get something. And unfortunately, they didn't have anything. Which I also was like, what? Don't they always have something? Even if they're the ones that are like the 2-pack
right.
of like Advil or Tylenol or something. They didn't even have that at this gas station, which was weird. I mean, it was a normal looking gas station.
Yeah, it was kind of weird. And my thought too was like, could it be that the kids were just loud in the car and she was like, I can't handle a 30-minute drive?
That could be too.
Like, I mean, I'm thinking, I get migraines. I don't know if you get migraines. I do. They're debilitating. And there's no way that I could make it 30 minutes. None.
Really? Okay. Yeah. So I've never had a migraine. I've had mild headaches, but nothing to the effect of migraines that can last people days.
Oh,
you know?
I've had them to the point where I've had to call people to come get me because I can't drive.
Oh,
it's bad.
Gosh.
So maybe that could be it. But I feel like if that were the case, and again, everybody's a little bit different. Some come on suddenly. Mine kind of build throughout the day. So I'm thinking if it were that, she might have mentioned it to Danny. He might have said,
yeah,
she said she had a headache or
she would have said something.
Right. So anyway, it probably wasn't a headache. I'm just saying.
Hey, there's so many
we don't know,
theories
right?
and ideas of what it could be because none of us know.
Right.
Now, Brian Schuler, as stated before, age 6 was the sole survivor in this crash. We get some on-screen text about him, and it states that Brian sustained a serious head injury in the crash. As a result, he is suffering from oculomotor nerve palsy, which affects movement in his right eye. He has undergone surgery for this injury and does daily eye exercises. Since the accident, Jay has been helping to take care of Brian 3 to 4 days a week and during the weekend. And we see Jay come back on the screen and she has family photos all over her fridge. And she's reminiscing a lot of the good times. And it's tragic. It's really, really sad. And she tells us that Warren and Jackie's grief is just too big. All of their little girls died. And again, that is out of this world. I don't know if I could go on living.
When
everything that I feel like I'm here for is gone or was taken from me.
Isn't it fucked up?
It is so fucked up. Seriously.
By the way, we made it like halfway through this with our first F-bomb.
We're doing good,
We're
guys.
We're doing good. Hashtag fuck.
We get another blurb of on-screen text. We asked all 4 families who lost loved ones in the crash to participate in this documentary. Jackie and Warren Hance declined to be interviewed for the film. And I really don't blame them. That would be so hard. I don't know if I could continue to talk about it or relive that day over and over again, especially on camera. I don't even think I could talk about it.
No. Well, and I feel like they probably have a lot of mixed emotions.
Yeah.
Like you had mentioned, you know, kind of being angry and bitter, but also at the same time, really sad about the whole situation.
Yeah.
I can't help but think they probably take a little bit of it personally.
Yeah. Oh, I would.
Yeah.
I would.
Yeah. We then find out about the other 3 people who were involved in this accident.
Yeah. For the first time.
For the first time. Yeah. So this comes up to us with on-screen text saying Guy Bastardi, 49, Michael Bastardi, 81, and Daniel Longo, 74, were killed in the car that was struck head-on by Diane's vehicle. We meet Guy Bastardi's sister, Roseanne Guzzo. Now, she remembers his voice on the phone that day calling to say that he was going to be coming over for dinner that night at her house, how he would be there and how he was excited about having spaghetti and meatballs, which I'm not even going to lie, my mouth watered as soon as I looked at that.
I know.
I'm not even hungry.
Well, and you can tell that they're like an Italian family.
Yes.
So they probably have really good homemade spaghetti.
For real. Yeah. Like the best.
Yes. Well, can you imagine getting to speak with him that day?
Yeah.
Like, that doesn't happen.
No.
That does not happen. And she actually got to speak with him for the last time. She didn't know it, obviously, at the time. But that's a great thing and a memory for her to hold on to, that she at least got to speak with him one more time.
Yeah.
And I just found that to be really cool.
Well, yeah, because another one of his sisters, Margaret Nicotina, says that she just doesn't feel like there's any closure for her. She says that, you know, they should have made it home that day and they didn't.
Yeah.
So
yep.
That's tough. When the sudden loss like that happens.
Right.
Now, Joseph Longo, Daniel Longo's brother, says that, you know, Daniel was healthy. He had retired recently and was really starting to enjoy himself and enjoy life. And that he just feels like his life was cut way too short. He had many years left in him, which, I mean, also, ugh.
Well, and this, again, is what makes this whole story so tragic, because if whatever didn't happen to Diane, if it didn't happen to her at that time of the day, so say if it was a medical issue, what if it hadn't have occurred until she got home?
Right.
Right? Maybe this whole thing could have been avoided. You kind of like think outside the box and think, well, what if whatever happened? But again, going back to that alcohol and marijuana and whatnot, obviously, that choice was not a great choice.
Right.
Right. To do that, even if she was in pain or what have you. I mean, call 911.
Yes.
Right?
Call anybody and to come get you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But again, it's like, we don't know.
We don't know.
She might have lost her damn mind.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Like, literally,
she could have
went
literally
crazy.
Split, like had a, you know, a split with reality.
Yes.
And
yes.
Yeah. So we don't know what happened. These are all speculations, people.
Yep.
And I mean, if you look it up, it's all over the place. Like,
yeah,
there's tons of theories that, you know, could have been, but nobody's going to know.
Nope. And we never get closure.
We don't.
On this case.
No. It then cuts back to Danny Schuler at home. And he's talking about how, you know, he's a single parent now to Brian, how, you know, he's busy with housework, schoolwork. He works night shift as a security guard. He talks about the lack of time to get everything done in a day. And he says how, you know, they talk a lot about Diane with Brian because that was his mom,
you
know, and he doesn't want Brian to have a bad memory of his mom or to think that his mom was a bad mom, because she wasn't.
Right.
She was a great mom, according to literally everybody who talks to her.
Every single
talks
person.
About her.
Every single person that knew her.
Yeah. Talks about how great of a mom she was. And he talks about how his son is, you know, he was 5 at the time of the accident, that school is really excellent support-wise for him, and that at this point in this documentary, he was not doing any type of therapy. Now, I just wanted to insert a little bit of personal information here.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah, so one thing that is really, really close to my heart is this case, and not in the exact same way, but because of the similarities. So in 2014, on July 4th, I woke up to an awful phone call from my best friend and her mom, who were very, very close to me for many, many, many years and still are, that the father of my daughter had passed away overnight in the wee hours of the morning due to drunk driving. He had been at the bar the night before, like July 4th, right?
Mm-hmm.
So July 3rd, once it went to like around bar close, so we're looking at like 1-2 in the morning.
Yeah.
He somehow snuck off with his keys and got into an accident by himself. There was no other vehicle involved, and he was, you know, dead on impact. So I wake up, you know, July 4th to all these phone calls about this.
Oh my God.
And my daughter at the time was 5. So we're looking at her starting kindergarten in like, what, 2 months? So I can tell you it's a very shocking phone call to get, especially when you don't expect something to happen.
Yeah.
His name was Jordan, and Jordan was a truck driver by trade. He had driven the entire time I knew him.
Yeah.
He was a driver, a class A driver. So the last thing we ever expected was a car accident.
Right.
In all honesty. Now, in this case, you know, neither one of them sound intentional, But I can say that at the time when I had to break the news to my daughter, because of course, I am the one who is in charge of doing that, she couldn't really grasp it. She sort of had an idea. Her words to me, almost verbatim, when I told her was, "So does that mean that I don't have a daddy anymore?" And I mean, that broke me at that time, right? We're both,
I'm getting goosebumps.
Yeah, we were both sobbing. And I told her, no, you're always going to have a daddy. We're just not going to see him anymore.
Yep.
So we kind of talked for a few minutes about it. But then, as you know, children do, she kind of almost bounced back really quick. And that day we had had plans with friends and she immediately wanted to go do them. She did not want to stop what we had already told her we were going to be doing for the 4th of July weekend. And at the time I was like, you know, why stop everything now? Let's get through and, you know, move on. Because
You want to keep a little bit of normalcy.
Right.
Because this is a huge tragedy and this is a life-changing event, especially for someone who's 5 years old and their mind cannot wrap around something like this. So kudos to you because you need to keep a little bit of normalcy because obviously you have a funeral coming up that's going to be hard, right? And to have to go through that. So, I mean, I think that was the perfect thing to do.
Yeah. And at the time it was very strange because we weren't together, but we had always been really close, and I. And through that last year of his life, we had gotten really close to the point where we would have family dinners together.
Yeah,
we
that's nice.
Took her to the circus one time. He called me and I walked him through a breakup. I mean, it was, we were best friends.
Yeah.
Through and through. And
that's
I had told him that's how we were going to be when we broke up.
Right.
I'm like, we're not going to be like feuding parents. We're going to be best friends, whether you like it or not.
Right.
So, and luckily it stayed that way. But when we talk about the shock of getting that type of phone call, I mean, I remember we had plans to go to the beach and I remember laying on the beach thinking, how is this fucking real right now?
Yeah.
Like this doesn't feel real because I was so outside of it. I wasn't, we didn't live together. So it wasn't like all of a sudden I'm looking at all of his stuff.
Yeah.
You know, it was very, I was very, the whole thing was very surreal. And to be honest, so at this time, Danny is saying, no, Brian's not in any therapy. And he kind of almost, in a way, kind of shrugs it off.
Yeah.
Like it's not a big deal.
Like he doesn't need it.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to say to anybody that watches this and sees that part, that he's very right. At that time, Brian probably didn't need anything.
Yeah.
Kaylin, for a long time, didn't want to talk about it. I mean, her and I would talk about, you know, daddy all the time. We still do. We talk about him all the time.
Yep.
We have pictures of him in our house. That's not, you know, we don't hide that. But for many years, she didn't tell anybody. I mean, she didn't tell her teachers. She didn't tell any friends. Nobody knew that her dad had passed away.
Yeah.
She didn't want people to know. And I was okay with that. However, I did tell her teachers because there were a couple of instances where things would come up and she would have a meltdown and people wouldn't really know why. And I'd have to kind of explain.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So I just kind of wanted to put that in there that at 5 years old, Kaylin also didn't see anybody for this. However, it was probably about 2.5 years later, she reached out to me and said, Mom, I want to talk to somebody about this.
Mm-hmm.
So we ended up seeking help.
Good for her. That's awesome. I think she probably realized that at some point it gets bottled up and it sits at the bottom of your stomach, right? And you need to talk about it with someone other than your mom or your parent, right? Because you've been through it together. You need to talk to an outside source that is trained in helping you recover and to cope with it.
Yeah. And we had the social workers in the school or like the counselors, you know, check in with her periodically. So they were aware, but she didn't know that that's what they were doing.
Right.
Which was kind of cool.
Right.
But yeah, I just thought I'd kind of bring that up.
Well, thank you for sharing.
Little side note. And I have more about that a little bit later, speaking to some more personal experiences.
Sure.
But I just kind of wanted to insert that so that you guys know a little bit more about me and our life.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now back to the documentary. Jay has said that she has asked Brian all the questions and that, you know, she kind of wants to probe him a little bit for information. And at the time, all Brian was saying was that mommy's head hurt and she couldn't see, which is, I think, why I brought up the migraine situation earlier.
Yeah.
Because migraines affect people differently.
Mm-hmm.
For me, I can't see. I mean, like, light is excruciating. Smells make me want to vomit. And sound, I mean, my head just wants to explode. So
yeah.
All the senses are like fucked
heightened,
up. Yep. Yeah. And big time. Yeah. Like heightened. But some people don't have that. Some people can have a migraine for several days and light doesn't bother them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I think I was talking about the migraine earlier, because I actually wrote it down. Migraine? Question mark?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. He then goes on to say that he doesn't remember anything else about it, except that he flew out of the car like Superman and that his story has never changed. So from day one, that's all he ever says.
Mm-hmm.
Mommy's head hurt. She couldn't see. And that he had flew out of the car like Superman.
Right. We're now on Route 17 and it's 11:37 a.m. Diane calls Jackie Hance, the mother of her nieces, and just says that they're running late. Normal phone call. Everything seems fine.
Yeah, it sounded like the girls actually had like a play practice or something that day.
Yes.
So I think she was probably just like, sorry, we're running late. Maybe they were supposed to be back to the house by a certain time.
Yep. Just a heads up. Normal heads up call.
Yeah.
We get to 12 p.m. Interstate 87 Thruway South. We see witness Gerald Salerno, and he states that he was driving in the center lane and Diane's vehicle came up quickly in the right lane and moved into the center lane. She continued switching lanes aggressively. He saw Diane gripped onto the steering wheel and she even cut off another vehicle to get back into the center lane. But he always says that her movements were very precise.
Yeah.
She was not all over the place. She didn't look like she was like swerving at all. She was very deliberate in what she was doing. And then he said that he saw the children's heads swaying. Oh my God. It gives me literally a stomach ache thinking about that.
Yeah. I just think about how fast. I'm imagining like a race car driver.
Yes, that's what I was thinking.
Because that's what it sounds like. It sounds very intentional. And like, she wasn't like swerving over into the right and then decided to go into the right lane. Like you've been behind somebody who you could tell is not paying attention or has maybe had too many drinks and shouldn't be driving.
Right.
And you see them kind of drift. And it doesn't sound like she was drifting at all.
Well, and you have to be going very fast and switching lanes if you see heads moving.
Exactly.
Like that is fast moving. So she must have been going, I would assume, 60 or 70 miles an hour if you're on a highway.
Yep.
And she is switching lanes very quickly because heads don't move like that when you're switching lanes.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We're now at 12:13 p.m. and we're at the Harriman Toll Plaza. And we meet Francis Bagley, who's another witness. And he said that Diane had got behind him and was so close to him that he couldn't even see her headlights. And she was beeping her horn like she needed to be somewhere. He was going too slow and he needed to get out of her way.
Yeah.
His wife, Jean, said that she was actually starting to brace herself for a crash because this was so out of the ordinary. And this person was erratic.
Yeah.
Driving erratically.
Yeah. Yeah. Very aggressive to the other drivers.
And Frances tells us that she even tried to pass him on the shoulder and ended up having to pull back behind him because there must have been another car in front of him that she wasn't able to squeeze in or something.
Yeah.
And they both got off at the next rest area, but Diane had pulled into the truck area, like the semi-truck area.
Yeah.
And not the car area. And they did see Diane get out of her vehicle. And it looked like she was going to get sick, like she was bent over and she was getting sick.
Yeah. Which in that case, I can understand trying to like get somebody to get the hell out of your way.
Sure.
Like if absolutely. I'm about to throw up.
Yeah, absolutely.
Move your ass.
Sure. And you're not just going to do that on the side of the highway, especially a big highway like that. You're not going to just pull off the side of the road to do it, especially if you're the driver. You're going to be with oncoming traffic.
Right.
You know, so you're going to want to get off. Now, Francis and his wife, Jean, had actually went back into the rest area. So there was like a McDonald's there. It was like a gas station.
Yeah.
And when they had came out, she wasn't there anymore. And that was around 12:30 p.m. They give us a little bit of a background next on Diane's childhood friends. And they're basically telling us about her life and their friendships with her. She was the class clown, always fun. She was loud and crazy. She had a really big personality, very responsible, and really had a great head on her shoulders.
Yeah.
And they also mentioned that she always struggled with her weight and she never actually dated when she was younger.
Mm-hmm.
And then she met Danny.
Yeah, she actually met Danny at one of their weddings.
Yes. And that kind of changed everything for her. Like Danny was for her. That was her man.
Yeah. She had lost a bunch of weight, the most weight that she'd ever lost right before this wedding.
Yes.
Shows up, probably feels like $1 million and attracts that attention.
And she literally looked like a different person.
Oh, yeah. I didn't recognize her.
You wouldn't have recognized her at all.
No, especially from like her childhood or like teenage photos that they were showing to that wedding photo. I was like, yep, nope. I would never have guessed that that was the same person.
No, absolutely not.
We're then back to the press conference and a reporter is asking Danny about the bottle of Absolut vodka that was found in the van. Danny claims he doesn't know where it came from.
Well, and you can see that his attorney was actually telling him not to say anything.
Yeah.
So he was kind of mouthing words like, leave it, don't say anything about it. Because I think they were still doing some investigation on it. So you don't want to put your foot in your mouth.
Absolutely.
Especially during a press conference because people are recording your every single word.
Right.
So it was probably better that he didn't say anything because I think this was still very new and fresh that they just had gotten this information. So it makes sense.
Yeah. Then cut to Larry King Live, an exclusive interview with Daniel Shuler and Larry King. And Jay Shuler is also there, we found out.
Yeah, yeah.
And Danny says that he knew that they had a bottle of vodka in the camper and that they usually leave it there all season, you know, for drinks around the campfire and so on and so forth. So to me, it sounds like, you know, in the beginning of the season, they pick up a bottle, they leave it in the camper. Then they just know that they have whatever. They can have a drink if they want to while they're on, you know, camping or not.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We do that every time we go somewhere camping.
Right. Yeah.
Or go on vacation. Come on.
Yeah. Or, you know, come over and do a podcast. I mean, whatever. Like, we always have a drink. So Danny claims he has no idea why she would have packed it in the bags and that he had just loaded all the bags into the car. Because, again, this happened in July, like July 26th. So this bottle should have stayed in the camper for, you know, at least another month, let's say. I mean,
if they're there all summer, that would make sense.
Yeah.
But to me, it's almost like she was hiding it for a reason. That's kind of the one thing that came into the back of my mind and why it didn't make sense to him.
Yeah.
Why it would be in there. But again, I'm speculating completely because we just keep going back to that alcohol factor.
Yeah.
And if he didn't know why she put it in there, she was very deliberate and putting it in there. And she felt like she needed to hide it.
Oh, yeah. She doesn't make mistakes.
Right.
With anything.
Right.
So this was definitely intentional to have the bottle with her in the vehicle, but we don't know why.
Right.
Now, Larry King goes on to say, you know, does it give you pause to think that maybe, just maybe, she was a drinker and you just didn't know it? And Daniel says, I have been with her for 13 years. Absolutely not. He has been basically throughout this entire documentary and throughout the whole, you know, situation, has been trying to prove that she wasn't a drunk for the other families involved in that crash. They want to make sure that nobody looks at her as just being another statistic.
I totally get that. But she was drunk.
Right.
And they can't dispute that.
Yeah.
She's maybe it's not habitual where she's doing it all the time and she's always drinking and driving. But because she was drinking, this tragedy happened.
Yes.
Clear as day, you cannot dispute that. So to me, I mean, I know that's his wife. He doesn't want her name to be drugged through the mud and have that bad.
Yes. Stained for the rest of
time. Yes. On it. He doesn't want that. And of course, I wouldn't want that for my husband or, you know, my significant other either. But you cannot dispute the fact that she was drunk when this happened.
Yes.
And it's unfortunate, but it's true.
We then cut back to the sisters of Guy Bastardi, and they're saying that they have gotten to a point where they forgive Diane. They pray for everyone who lost their lives that day, including Diane. They've kind of forgiven her for the fact that, you know, she took their brother away.
That is so upstanding to do. Yeah. I mean, it's really hard to forgive people. It really, truly is.
Yeah.
And I've done it myself before, but it's hard, especially when they take something from you, especially someone's life.
Yeah.
I can't imagine.
It's tough. It's very tough. And they do say, though, that they're still working on the family that's still alive.
Yep.
Because, again, we all know that she was drinking that day. And it's one thing to acknowledge that, but it's another thing to completely try to say that that's false.
Or that something wasn't done right.
Right. I mean, they think that the DNA from this blood test was not even Diane's.
Right.
I mean, that's very, I don't know.
It could happen.
Sure.
It totally could happen. Now, the percentage as to how many times that has happened is probably extremely small.
Yeah.
But I think they're just in the sense of denial. Yeah. There's no way she could have done this. But it's like, she did, though.
Yeah.
So I think they have to work through that acceptance. I think they haven't gotten to that point yet of accepting the fact that, yes, she was drunk when she killed all these people. It's plain as day. It's unfortunate. We don't know what got her to that point or why she did that.
What triggered that.
But you cannot deny the facts.
Right.
I mean, that was in her system. You can't deny that. And the marijuana, too. So what if she had never done both together?
Right.
Right? What if she always drank or just, you know, smoked weed or whatever? And now she did both together and
oh my gosh,
could have totally screwed her up. You know what I mean?
Big time. I mean, worst is to smoke after you've been drinking.
I can't do it.
I certainly remember, you know, being younger and going to parties or going to the bar and then doing the after party at someone's house and somebody breaks out a joint. And I remember without fail, I would be, first off, super fucked up if I tried to smoke after drinking that evening, and it would 100% always induce the spins and vomiting.
Yes.
Every time. I mean, it intensified more.
100%.
But I would be fine if I smoked before I drank, because then I was almost like too high to drink.
Right.
So it was like, it was more like a chill night.
It was a different reaction.
Yeah. And if I just drank by itself, I mean, obviously, depending on the amount, I was generally okay. But if I tried to mix, no.
That would make sense.
Yeah.
That would totally make sense, because we still don't know when she would have smoked all the marijuana, because she had so much in her system. So it's like, did she do that with the kids in the car? Like, that's another thing that I'm puzzled by.
Yes, me too. It just doesn't sound, it's just so weird.
And I think that is why Danny and Jay keep coming back to this, that it doesn't make sense, because it doesn't.
Yeah.
None of it makes sense, but the facts are the facts. And you cannot say that she was not drunk, because she was.
Well, and I just thought about this. So the fact when she pulls over at that rest stop and she gets out of the car and she's kind of bent over like she's about to be sick.
Yeah.
What if she stopped at that moment and smoked a little bit to try to counteract the nausea?
Ooh.
That just came to me. I don't know. Maybe.
That could have totally happened. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, if she was feeling sick, and maybe not right at that moment when she stopped at the rest stop, but maybe that's what kind of made her want to smoke.
Absolutely.
I don't know.
Totally could have been it.
Yeah. I mean, I know people who use that as a hangover cure.
Well, yeah. And you know what? It's never going to be known.
I mean,
that's the frustrating part. It's so frustrating, because you want to know what happened, but we just don't know.
We don't know. Now, the family of Guy Bastardi are still just so upset about the fact that the stories about the bottle kept changing. So they kept saying that, you know, they believed something happened between them, and that Danny had some type of denial about his wife being drunk and irresponsible that day, which, I mean, to an outsider, I could totally understand that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So I totally get their way of thinking. We then cut to some footage of Danny going through some of, it looks like old planners, like monthly planners of Diane's, pointing out different doctor's appointments that she had written down here and there, and dentist appointments. We get some on-screen text saying that we enlisted the assistance of Dr. Harold Burston, who reviewed the police reports and our interview footage in order to come up with a quote-unquote forensic psychiatric autopsy of the case. Now, basically what this is going to do is they're going to attempt to piece together the state of mind and who the person was at the time of that event.
Yes.
Now, I wrote down Dr. Harold because I'm not going to try to stumble over his name again. He says that, you know, people want to preserve her memory, but they also want to know exactly what happened. It seems like the family can't accept the truth.
Right.
But also that they don't want to accept that she was a bad person, because she wasn't a bad person. She just made a bad choice that day.
Well, they think that because of this accident, it's going to somehow overshadow her entire life.
Yeah.
I mean, outsiders, people who don't know her, yes, are going to think that she's a drunk driver and that was her way of life, and let them think that. Her family and her real friends obviously know who she was and would never think she's a bad mother because of this one mistake. Of course. But again, it goes back to the sleuths on the internet and looking at comments. And you can't do that, because it literally will drive you crazy.
Yeah. Well, and because you know, she's been demonized in the media over this.
Yes.
Her family is kind of doing the opposite and making her into a saint, which I think is something that happens when almost anybody passes away. All of a sudden, all of their faults are completely erased and they were the best person on the planet, right?
They light up the room every time they walk in.
Yes. And they never did anything bad in their life. And it's like, okay, I get that. However, we also have to understand that every person is human.
Mm-hmm.
And every human has flaws.
And we all make mistakes.
We do. Except us.
Except us. Yeah. Except us. Exactly.
Yeah. Like, we won't be cutting half of what we're recording right now because we fucked up.
No one has to know that, Amy.
Oh my gosh. Sorry. Cut that.
Now, we meet Joseph and Irene Schuler, who are Danny's parents. And they tell us that Danny was madly in love with Diane. We obviously see that through this whole documentary.
Oh, yeah.
He is behind her 100%.
Without a doubt.
Always.
I mean, he has no doubts.
No doubts at all. And they say that Diane was so motherly and just a lovely person overall. But they did also mention that she was the boss.
Yeah.
She made all the decisions. We hear that a lot. She's very, very controlling as a person. And that's not always a bad thing.
No.
I mean, people like control. They like to know what's happening in their life. They like to take control of everything.
Can I tell you what made me feel kind of icky during that little blurb?
Yeah.
Was when his mom says that, you know, Danny was like her oldest. He was like her oldest son. She said it like 3-4 times.
I know.
And the whole time I'm like, ew.
Honestly, I forgot that she said that. And that is,
I wrote it down because it was literally like ick factor. I mean, creepy crawlies. I don't know. I mean,
it was weird.
Every wife will tell you that their husband is like their oldest child. But
yes,
that person's mother shouldn't be also seeing that.
It was, I don't know. Strange.
It was a little icky. I just had to. Ugh.
We then get on-screen text that states that at the time of death, Diane Schuler was the director of credit, billing, and collections at Cablevision, earning a salary of approximately $100,000 annually, which is kudos. Great.
Yeah, she seemed to be really liked at her job.
Absolutely. And she seemed to know her shit.
Yeah.
She had her shit together and she knew how to do her job and do it well.
Yeah.
One of Diane's coworkers even says that she seemed to be very good at anything she attempted. She was great at her job. And she was a take charge kind of person.
Yeah.
And she also says that she was always doing something for someone. She was constantly staying busy and staying organized. We meet another one of Diane's friends, Noreen Smith. And she, again, states that she made everything look easy, even when her and Danny worked opposite schedules. So she worked during the day, Danny worked nights, which, holy shit, I could not do that.
No.
With my husband. I need my husband home with me at night, spending time with the kids. I like that.
Yeah.
And so that is tough. That is really hard to do, to almost be a parent by yourself sometimes, depending on when that other parent has to work, if they're sleeping or what have you.
Right.
That would be really tough. Well,
and if one person is working nights, they're sleeping during the day.
Yes. And to keep your relationship afloat.
Yeah.
You know, to make that always work. So that's pretty awesome that she was able to do that. But I'm sure it was a lot for her.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like she almost kind of thrived in that, though.
Yes.
Because Noreen even goes on to say that, you know, the kids were literally dressed perfectly, like didn't have even a toothpaste stain on their clothing ever. They were always dressed impeccably. The, you know, she was always the first one to drop them off at school. Like, she was super mom.
Yeah. Yeah. And she said that she thought it was because of the mom she never had, really.
Oh,
and
totally.
She wanted to be better than that.
Yeah, I think she wanted, she overcompensated.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now we meet the private investigator for the Schulers, who's Thomas Ruskin, and they look into the toxicology report to make sure it was done correctly. And they were going to pool all their money together and retest. And they gave actually quite a bit of money to Tom Ruskin and his firm.
Yeah, it sounded like, I mean, 30 grand.
Yeah, I think they said they started with 10 grand and then they had to give him 30 grand. I'm like, who has this kind of money just laying around? But they said that it was hard. I mean, they had to pool it together with their whole family to try and get this money.
Yeah.
Jay tells us then that they thought Thomas Ruskin was going to save the day. He kept asking for more money, the 10K, then the 30K. They didn't have any more. After they gave him what they had, they didn't have any more. And as soon as they paid him, he disappeared. They had no idea what happened to them. Now, we find out a little bit later that it looks like they weren't answering some of his phone calls. So again, I think there's some missing information that
there's
we didn't get.
There's miscommunication for sure.
Absolutely. Someone told someone not to answer his phone calls anymore, which I wouldn't understand why, because isn't he retesting the samples? I don't know. It was a little all over the place with this, but I think we're missing a little bit of information. But at that time, they thought they were being played.
Right. It sounded like they almost kind of took Tom as like a con man.
Absolutely.
And I think their attorney was advising them not to take his calls or not to reach out, maybe.
Yeah, must have been.
It was kind of weird. We then get some on-screen text saying Tom Ruskin's firm did conduct an investigation, which included interviewing Diane's friends and family, canvassing the campground and the route for leads, and obtaining video footage from Sunoco Station. According to Ruskin, all monies were spent on these activities and on the lab tests. However, you know, Danny claims that they paid him and then they never saw him again. So,
and they never got any results.
Right. We then see like a telephone conversation between the filmmakers of the documentary and Tom Ruskin, basically, you know, reaching out to see if they could get some information or whatever lab results he had received. And Tom is going on to say, like, basically, give me 25 grand and I'll give that information to you.
25 grand.
Yeah. And the filmmakers are like, that's kind of like way out of the ballpark of what a documentary would pay.
Right.
And he goes, yep, I totally get it. I mean, it was so weird. Why would it be $25,000?
Well, he was saying that it's just not worth it to get those files out of archive. It's like, it would probably take you 30 minutes. What are you talking about? What kind of archive do you have at your operation there? Like, it can't be that much. And right. I'm assuming it's probably digital.
Well, and not
what
to mention,
hell?
It's not like he's going to be the one doing it. He
exactly.
probably has a minion somewhere that's running errands like this for him. It was very weird.
Yeah. And he must have, I mean, he just loves himself and he's on his high horse and he only gets paid a certain amount of dollar per hour or whatever. I mean, that's kind of how he operates. So I just don't even think he didn't care at all.
Right. No. Now, it does say that the documentary was able to obtain some of her medical records. And it cuts to a scene of Jay and Danny kind of going through these records. And, you know, they're thinking that it all kind of boils down to this like tooth issue or an undone root canal that Diane hadn't finished getting fixed because it was so painful, but had multiple appointments for.
Right. And I can totally relate to that. I have had terrible tooth problems and root canals, and it's awful.
Ugh.
But it was kind of weird that they said that she didn't finish her root canal because whenever I went in, it's a one-time procedure. So there must have been some underlying things that she had to get done prior or something, because that was a little strange.
Well, and they do mention at one point that she got up and left in the middle of an appointment.
Oh, that's right.
So I'm wondering if, I don't know if maybe it was taking too long or maybe it was too painful or maybe they hadn't even actually started the actual procedure.
Could
be. She just kind of got up and left.
Could be.
So yeah, we don't really know.
We're now at 12:55 p.m. A wrong number had been dialed from Diane's phone. We see James Boyle again. He's that investigator from the New York State Police Department. And he explains that around 1 p.m., Diane called Jackie Hance and sounded disheveled and disorientated. Then at 1:01 p.m., there's a 2.5-minute call that ends abruptly from Diane to Jackie. Warren, her brother, calls Diane back. He stated she didn't sound like herself and called him Danny at one point.
Yeah.
So she is completely out of her mind. She must be. If she's doesn't even know who she's talking to, right?
Yeah.
And the kids were crying in the background. Oh my God, that killed me.
I can only imagine the amount of fear and just fear is the only thing I can think of that they had going on. Just this is their aunt. This is their mother who always has her shit together.
Oh my gosh.
And at this moment, that's not her.
Especially the 10-year-old Emma.
Yeah.
I couldn't imagine what she was going through, right?
Right?
Warren had told Diane to stay put and he would be right there. Now at 1:02 p.m., so 1 minute later, we're at the Tappan Zee Bridge and the oldest Emma was actually on the phone with her mom telling her that there was something wrong with Aunt Diane. Oh God, it's like bone chilling hearing that.
Yeah.
Now Emma also says that Aunt Diane can't see. And they had been pulled over at this time, and Emma had told her dad a sign that she was able to see, and she said that it said Tarrytown. Now, Warren races up from Long Island to the Tappan Zee Bridge, trying to find them. We're now at 1:10 p.m., and someone dials three wrong numbers from Diane's phone. At 1:15 p.m., Warren Hance tries to reach Diane. The call goes to voicemail.
Ugh.
It's just haunting.
I can just imagine the anxiety and panic building in him, trying to get a hold of her, and she's not answering. And then it goes to voicemail. I've had those, you know, those feelings.
Yes. Well, and this to me, there had to have been a mental break. Yeah. If she couldn't see and she's outside of the vehicle, now she's not in the vehicle anymore.
Right.
Why would she get back in to go driving again?
I know.
If she can't, like, something mentally was not there for her at that time, because if she was still coherent enough to realize that she can't see, she wouldn't go anywhere. She'd probably sit there on the side of the road, right?
Right.
But again, she's drunk and high, so something else is happening to her body.
Like, not being able to see.
Oh my God.
And she's driving straight as an arrow.
Weird.
How?
Weird.
I mean,
it's almost like your body's instinctual thing, maybe. Like, your body.
To me like she's like possessed.
Yes. Oh my God. Yes.
Right. Like, ooh. Or yeah, just like invasion of the body snatcher. Like,
yes,
it just
absolutely.
Sounds so, it just sounds so like opposite.
Creepy. It's creepy.
Yeah.
To me.
She shouldn't have been able to drive that straight with how fucked up she was.
Right.
And if she was that fucked up, she shouldn't have been able to see. Like, right. I mean, it was just like, ugh.
It was all over the place.
It totally.
Well, we also find out that she left her phone on the cement divider on the Tappan Zee Bridge. So we knew that she had been outside the vehicle. This is when Emma must have called her mom.
Yeah, they were pulled over.
Yep. Yeah. And her route had been normal up until that Tappan Zee Bridge when she got off the highway. So that is when she veered off and got off the highway where she would have originally kept going on the highway to get home.
We then get a little bit of an interview with Christine Lipani. Now, she is one of Diane's like best friends.
Yeah.
Current best friends,
yep.
Not childhood. And she goes on to speak about some character traits of Diane. You know, again, very controlling, very in charge. It sounds like she's one of those people where it was her way or no way.
Yeah.
If you were doing something with Diane, Diane was planning it 100% and you were along for the ride.
Absolutely.
Yep. Which, personally, kind of like those people because I'm kind of lazy. But that's what it sounds like she was. It sounds like she was also one of these people that was very organized, meticulous, but she also spoke her mind. So what Christine says is if she had a problem with you, you'd know about it.
Yep.
You wouldn't have to guess.
She wouldn't
would tell you.
Nope.
Yeah. She was very blunt. But it also sounds like she was a very private person as well. So I think she, you know, again, kind of overcompensated for maybe all of those feelings of being abandoned as a child, mm-hmm. to being really strong and not letting anyone else ever put her in that feeling again.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So she was very, very private. Didn't bring up a lot of things. Now, the documentary crew arranged to have a DNA test done to match Diane's DNA to the toxicology report. At that time, they'd also received more records from Diane's dentist, kind of giving an impression of her having some more tooth pain,
yep.
possibly an abscess, a broken tooth, and she grinded her teeth as well.
Yeah, and I think that's really crucial information to know. It gives you a better background of what type of health problems she had, because having bad teeth is a very bad health problem.
Yeah.
It's horrible and it sucks. I've been there, done that. I never want to have to go through it again, you know, and it sucks.
Yeah.
We meet Betsy Spratt. She's the director of toxicology for Westchester County. And she shows us where they set up to test alcohol levels for blood, urine, whatever it is.
Yeah.
She showed us the area where they do that. And Diane had just over 10 drinks in her at the time that she had died, like we stated. Again, her blood alcohol content was 0.19%, but her gastric contents were 0.25%.
Yeah.
So
that
even,
hadn't been metabolized yet.
Right. So even 0.06% higher than her blood alcohol content. So that is crazy to me.
Yeah.
So she could have even been way more impaired than we thought, because it tells us the psychological effects of what alcohol can do to you at these types of percentages. So at 0.11 to 0.20%, your reaction time goes down, you lose gross motor control, you're staggering, you have slurred speech, very standard stuff that we've all seen before.
Sure.
at 0.21 to 0.29%.
Which is where she was gastrically.
Yes. We get stupor, loss of understanding, severe motor impairment, loss of consciousness, memory blackout. I mean, we're getting to the point of some people can die at this point.
Right. Right? This is at this point. I mean, after a 0.20 blood alcohol content, that's alcohol toxicity.
Absolutely. And it's crazy that she was at 0.25 in her gastric contents. Yeah. I mean, I'm no doctor. I don't really know what that actually means. But to me, that means that she was more drunk than we thought she was.
Yeah, it was. To me, it means it was sitting in her stomach. Yet,
yes.
And it hadn't gone into her bloodstream, which Absolutely. Is why her bloodstream showed a lower percentage.
Absolutely.
Or it's that her body had already burned off a little bit of it.
Could be. It's hard to tell.
Yeah. The toxicology report also mentioned that she had 113 nanograms per milliliter of THC in her system at that time.
Which is a lot. They say that she could have smoked anywhere between 15 minutes to an hour before the crash.
Yeah.
So it was very recent that she had smoked.
Right. Because originally when I thought about this whole having the marijuana in her system, I was like, okay, we all know that marijuana does not metabolize out of your system within a day like alcohol, right? Which is why they can drug test you. And even if you didn't just smoke that day, it could still show up as a positive drug test.
Right.
Or, you know, failing the drug test.
Exactly.
So at first I was like, well, maybe they smoked at night after the kids went to bed the last night camping. It was still in her system. But when they look at the amount, it actually tells you that this would have been done in a much closer time frame to the accident occurring.
Exactly.
Now, witnesses to the incident state that they claim that her driving was very straight, very intentional, but that she was driving really fast, like around 70 miles per hour.
Yes, everyone was saying that she was driving straight. Her head wouldn't even turn
look
at them.
Yeah, she looked like a woman on a mission. And they said that, you know, if they were to give like a description of it, they said it almost looked like as if she was playing chicken.
Perfect example of that, too.
Right. Just, I mean, balls to the wall, like no flailing.
Well, and we heard from a witness that she thought that she was trying to kill herself.
Yeah, she said she looked like it was dead set, or that she was dead set on killing herself. So intentional about what she was doing.
And not one of them, unfortunately, knew that there was kids in that car.
Yeah.
I mean, not that they could have changed anything, because all of them were terrified. Obviously, she's going the wrong direction, coming straight for them.
Right.
Like, could you imagine being on a highway with something like that happening?
I mean, I've been on a highway once before where a vehicle was coming towards me, like in the, you know, going the wrong direction. But I think it was one of those, like, they weren't from the area, so they were a little lost because they weren't doing what she was doing.
Right.
They weren't going that fast.
Yep.
But I remember thinking, holy shit, this person is coming
right.
at me.
Yeah. Now, Danny and Jay meet with Dr. Werner Spitz, and he's actually one of America's most respected medical examiners, to answer the Schuler's questions about the autopsy and discuss options for retesting. Now, if you recall, he actually was one of the medical examiners to examine JFK, Martin Luther King, OJ, JonBenet Ramsey, Casey Anthony, a lot of big cases. He's been around
everybody.
For a long time. Yes.
Yeah.
Especially JFK and Martin Luther King. This guy is old
as fuck.
He's old, but he's awesome. I'm literally obsessed with him.
No,
he's fantastic.
He's cool.
Now,
and he's like no bullshit.
He's not. No.
Like, when you listen to him speak, I was just like,
he's so intelligent and knows what he's talking about. And I think he's tired of people always questioning him because he's like, I've been doing this for 85 years.
Yeah.
So yeah. Don't tell me what's right and what's wrong.
That's kind of what it was. But yet not being like rude.
Right.
But kind of like, no, this is not how you think.
Exactly. And he reviewed the case and thought the autopsy was done correctly and properly. He said that alcohol and marijuana was what caused this crash. And Jay mentions that she doesn't want Diane to be the poster child for drunk driving. Again, they're reiterating that fact that they don't want her to be a poster child for drunk driving, but she was.
Yeah.
She was. And I think they're missing the fact that it's not that she does it every single time.
Right.
It's that she was at that time. It takes one time to be a drunk driver and kill someone. And you're now the poster child for drunk driving because you decided to do that.
Absolutely. Kind of like it takes one time having sex to get knocked up.
Exactly.
Like, it doesn't mean that you are a habitual, you know, somebody who does it all the time.
Right. Right. And so, and I'm not trying to degrade the family at all.
No.
Their sorrow and their sadness. And I can understand that you don't want them to look bad, but you also have to remember that is what happened.
And there are a lot of other people that were affected by this.
Yes. And something medically could have happened.
Sure.
But that was the main cause because she had so much in her system that was the only thing that makes sense.
Yeah.
Now, Danny asks about her abscess tooth and if that could cause a stroke. And Dr. Spitz tells us that in theory, yes. But based on the autopsy, there was none that he saw microscopically. For a stroke anyways.
Right. He saw no evidence of that.
Because he says that when a stroke happens, there's this big ball that will show up microscopically in their brain matter that they can see that something happened, but it didn't happen in her case.
Yeah.
Now, Werner Spitz says that the question of the alcohol will always prevail, like we just said, because the family was trying to go on that abscess tooth stroke theory. You know, that's kind of what they wanted to go based off of that this medical event happened. But Werner Spitz says that if she did have an abscess tooth, she could have been in so much pain that she takes whatever's available to get rid of the pain. And again, they did not have medicine for her at that gas station.
Right.
So I could believe that story. That story is very believable to me. And again, we get Danny and Jay arguing that she wouldn't do that. But she did. She did, though. Like, I know you want to say that she didn't. She did, though. So, yeah. And I think you could tell that Dr. Spitz is getting a little irritated at this point. He's trying to be compassionate with them.
Well, it's like beating a dead horse.
Yes. Because he keeps telling them, like, well, you will only be satisfied if you send it to another lab to retest and exhume her body. So, yeah, I get that because this world-renowned medical examiner is telling them that everything that he looked at seemed to point in the direction that the original autopsy was done correctly. And they still are saying that it couldn't be true. It couldn't be true.
Right.
It's just they're not there at that acceptance point yet. They haven't gotten to that step yet.
Yeah. Right after the interview with Dr. Werner Spitz, there's some on-screen text that says, according to the NMS labs, Tom Ruskin had the specimen retested 9 months prior to this.
So he did actually do the testing. Even though they didn't get the results, he did the testing.
He did the testing. There's a phone call between Tom Ruskin and Jay Schuler. She finally gets a hold of him. And Tom is telling her that the samples that they sent in to be retested came back the exact same. So it was her DNA. The autopsy was done correctly. Everything came back the same. And Jay's a little confused because they just don't know where the ball was dropped. Tom claims he was trying to get a hold of them. We kind of mentioned this earlier.
Yep.
I mean, it's just kind of a back and forth thing, right?
Yep.
Now, Jay is also talking about Danny and how he's having a problem accepting what had happened. He's stuck in his grief. He hasn't reached out for help. She is the one that finally got Brian into therapy. She thinks that, you know, he needed to talk to somebody. She feels overworked because she's been working 14-hour days, plus helping out with Brian most of the week and on the weekends because, again, Danny works, you know, nights.
Yeah.
And she says that she gets really frustrated because at one point, Danny says to her that he kind of feels like Diane left him in this situation as a single parent.
Yeah.
Because he mentions that he had never wanted kids and that that was something that she had wanted. And now he kind of almost feels betrayed.
Yeah.
In a way. And Jay is obviously kind of pissed about this when she's talking about it.
Yeah.
And I also want to insert my own little experience here because I was kind of in Danny's situation in a sense, you know, abstractly. But I remember initially being like really, really, you know, shocked about it.
Yeah.
And then it was really like really hard and really sad. But I got to a point where I would get really, really mad at Jordan.
Mm-hmm.
I remember specifically trying to teach Kaylin how to ride her bicycle. And I don't have a lot of patience. I'm better. I work on it daily.
Yes.
I don't have a lot of patience.
I am right there with you, girl.
And I remember trying to teach her and she would get frustrated and then I would get frustrated. And the first day that we tried was a bust. I had put her to bed and I come out into the living room and I was so fucking mad and I was sobbing to myself in the living room and cursing Jordan for leaving this earth and leaving me with this task of teaching our daughter how to ride a bicycle. I was pissed. Then I was thinking about her first day of school and I'm like, this is fucking bullshit. We are both supposed to be walking her to the bus on her first day of school. Yeah. Why am I stuck doing all of this with everything? So I totally get that. I think it's a form of grief. There has to be levels of grief. There probably are, but I think anger is one of them.
Yeah.
And I remember that so vividly. I mean, I got mad. I remember calling somebody. I can't remember if it was a friend or a family member.
I think I would too if I was in your position.
Yeah. I was just like, this isn't fucking fair.
Yeah.
Why do I have to do all of this now?
Yeah.
Like, why did he have to go and do this? And it wasn't that he did it intentionally, but it was like, why did he put himself in the situation?
Right.
To leave us.
It could have been prevented.
Yes. So I get that. I totally get that.
Now, the only thing I had a problem with was that he said he never wanted children. And now he's left taking care of his son, Brian, by himself. And that hurt me a little bit. I'm like, I think there's a lot of people. I didn't want kids.
I didn't either.
I did not want kids.
Nope,
when I was a teenager, even when I was like 19, 20, like I was dead set on not having kids because I'm like, they cost a lot of money. They're a lot of work.
Oh, yeah.
All this
and
stuff.
I don't really like kids.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've been around kids a lot in my life.
I'm not a kid person.
Yes. And I agree. I'm totally that way too. But when I had my child.
Oh, totally different.
It changes everything.
Yes.
Like, because they become everything in your life.
Yeah.
So it hurt me a little bit that he said it that way. Now, again, we're not hearing it directly from his mouth.
Right.
This is Jay relaying what she had heard from him. So context could be out of it a little bit, but that was like, oh, that's still tragic to say. And now you have your 6-year-old boy who's still alive with you.
Yeah.
Like that should be something that you are thankful for every single day because you still get to have something. You get to still have a little bit of Diane, especially if you're missing her, you know, like, but it seemed like he didn't think of that way. But again, I can't imagine that type of trauma and that type of tragedy to have to go through that. I'm sure there's anger there. And I'm sure there's words that are said that you don't necessarily really mean.
Yeah.
They're coming out of anger and a place of denial and sadness.
Think about it this way. He also has a little piece of Diane.
Right.
All the time.
Yeah.
Looking at him, talking to him, asking him questions, doing things that she would have done. I can't tell you how many times I will look at Kaylin and I'm like, holy shit, you're your dad.
Yeah.
Like, how do you even do that? Like, I mean,
this DNA, it's genetics.
It is genetics because she only saw him for the first 5 years of her life. And she still will do things where I'm like, how do you have his same side grin?
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, ugh. Or she'll say something or do something. And I'm like, God, you're your dad.
Yeah.
And it's just like, ugh, I want to choke you. But, you know, so I think that's another part of it, too. And
absolutely.
And honestly, it's frustrating being a single parent.
Yeah, I can't imagine.
It's one thing to be a single parent. It's another thing to literally be the only parent.
Yeah.
And so I get it. And I don't think at any point he doesn't love Brian. But I think it gets to be it's a lot. It gets to be a lot. And it gets really overwhelming. And
yes.
And in his case.
Yeah.
Right. And in his case, I mean, I hate to say like, I mean, I'm the woman. So I already was used to taking care of the house and her. I had her, you know, most of the time.
Right.
In his case, I mean, he was used to Diane doing everything.
Mm-hmm.
So that also had to have been a big shock.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're now at 1:35 p.m. We're at the Taconic Parkway northbound mile marker 4.1. There's a call to 911. Oh, my God. There's been an accident. There's an accident. An off-duty New York City police officer called in to state that he was at the scene and there was fatalities. Send an ambulance, may have a possible car fire, the car may blow up. A witness also stated that someone was screaming that there were kids in the car. So he and another guy went down to try and get the door open, but they couldn't. And they couldn't find the driver. The car was fully engulfed in flames in the front. And they were finally able to get the passenger door open.
So they open up the door and Diane tumbles out.
You guys.
Basically on top of them.
This is so tragic and horrifying. They show us pictures of her on the ground. And I'm telling you,
it's a close up.
It is nightmares. I still am thinking about it right now.
I know you are so creeped out by it.
I am so creeped out. I had to like put my notebook like in the front of my face because I knew it was coming. Because again, I've seen this years ago.
Right.
But I still remembered what her face looked like. I told you even. I was like, she's going to have her eye open a little bit. And it is creepy.
No, it's just so creepy. I know you're not a dead body person.
I love true crime, but that dead bodies and stuff is hard for me.
That's a little too true.
It's really hard for me, especially when you see photos. It's hard. It's tough.
Yeah. The witnesses then go on to try to get the kids out of the car. So they see that there are multiple children in the vehicle. They said it's just a chaotic scene for all involved. I mean, there's three cars involved. One of them doesn't have anybody who had passed away, but then there are eight people who have died.
Yep.
So, you know, there's bodies everywhere. Now, Brian is found, but he's conscious when he's found because they say that he's crying and he's kind of combative.
Yeah.
So he's got to be in a state of shock.
And that's a good thing if they're crying. That means they're not unconscious. That obviously means they're not dead.
Right.
So rush that child to the hospital.
Yes. They said that, you know, he was underneath everyone in the car. So my guess is they were kind of flying around in there and he was almost kind of protected.
Yeah.
Yeah. They also said, you know, because the highway is shut down. I mean, nobody is moving at this point. That people were getting out of their vehicles and trying to take pictures of the victims. And I'm just like, what the fuck?
That is
why would you want a picture of a dead body?
Probably to post online, I mean,
I understand like the whole, no, I'm guilty of it. You come up on an accident. I mean, I'm like gawking.
Yeah.
I mean, I try not to do it to the, you know, to a degree of like stopping traffic while I'm doing it. But I kind of want to see him fucking nosy.
Well, everyone's curious. We're human beings. We have curious natures about us. So it makes sense. But to do that, that's wrong many levels.
Totally. Next, we see picture by picture of all of the victims involved in the accident. So starting off with Michael Bastardi, 81 years old. Guy Bastardi, 49 years old. Daniel Longo, 74. Diane Schuler was 36. Erin Schuler, her daughter, was 2. Kate Hance was 5. Allison Hance was 7. And Emma Hance was between 8 and 10 years old.
I think I screwed that up, you guys. I think she was 8.
You think she was 8?
I apologize. I think she's 8.
Okay, because I thought she was also older than 8.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
Yeah. Well, girls always typically act older than,
that's true.
Than they are.
And she was the oldest of her family. So
yeah, I don't know why I was thinking 10. So my apologies.
That's okay.
Now, one of the last things that we get to see is Jackie Hance, the mom of the three nieces of Diane Schuler that were killed in the car accident. She had actually sent a car to Evan, who again is Jay's son. And to sum it up, she says, "I miss seeing you, Brian, and your whole family. Warren and I are broken, but you need to go and live a happy life. By doing this, you will show Brian that he can do the same. My life ended July 26, 2009. For whatever reason, my purpose for living was taken. When you have children one day, you will understand. You live and breathe your kids. I pray my pain will end soon and I can see my girls. Give Brian a hug and a kiss." Oh, I'm getting goosebumps again.
Like, I know.
That is so tragic. And it just, again, it reiterates the fact that she probably feels like she has nothing to live for anymore. Her whole entire life was taken from her. And it seems like her and Warren are still together. And she even had stated in the letter that Warren doesn't even let her out of her sight anymore.
Yeah.
Because
I bet he's very protective.
Very protective. He doesn't want anything to happen to her because he can't take any more tragedy, I'm sure. And it's just, it's so heartbreaking.
It is.
Now, we see on-screen text that Danny still wants to conduct a second autopsy, but has been unable to secure the necessary permissions to exhume Diane's body. Brian continues to go to therapy. And that's it. That's where it ends. That's where this documentary closes out. And we don't get any closure.
No, no. As nobody else did either.
Right. I mean, we know it's a closed case. We know who did this.
Right. There was no question.
Right. We know how this tragic accident happened. But why it happened and where it stemmed from, we still won't have those answers.
Yeah. Well, we will never know what actually took place that day. That mystery died with Diane. You know, was she in pain? Was she trying to distract from a seemingly perfect, person that she portrayed to be.
Right.
You know, all answers to questions that we're never going to receive. Now, I think this story is one of those that, while not exactly true crime, leaves us scratching our heads. But that's life,
yep.
isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks again so much for tuning in. And thank you for all of the love and the support for Sheer Crime. We'd love it if you could take a few moments to rate and review us on iTunes to help our show be seen by even more true crime enthusiasts.
Exactly.
Please feel free to share this with any friends or family that you know may enjoy a little true crime podcast to listen to.
Yeah.
You can email any of your requests to us at requests@sheercrimepodcast.com. You can follow us on Instagram. We now have an Instagram.
We do.
It's @sheer_crime_podcast. Don't forget to follow us on all social media platforms. You can follow Kenzie at mmillard08. That's mmillard08. And then you can follow me at amy_sawada, AME_SOWADA on all of the things.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, as always, we have our Sheer Crime Podcast discussion group on Facebook.
Yes, we're having fun.
Yes, feel free to join us. We are posting memes. We are putting up updates. We are also taking requests there.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just a fun time.
Yeah, why not, right?
Yeah.
Who doesn't love Facebook groups? Come on.
I mean, come on. I got like 1,000 of them.
I do too.
I got ones I don't even know I'm part of. I'm
I like, know.
Why am I getting notifications that, oh, you're in a group.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Next week, we're going to be covering the Netflix documentary Killer Inside, The Mind of Aaron Hernandez. So don't forget to tune in.
Yes, it's going to be a good one.
It is going to be a good one. And as always, never run with scissors. Bye, guys.
See ya.